Caregivers, have you ever felt like nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and welcome to Dave, the Caregivers Caregiver Radio Program on HealthStar Worldwide, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grieving process. They say that there are only three types of people in the world: those who are caregivers, those who will become caregivers, and those who will someday need a caregiver. Join Dave and his guests now and every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific on HealthStar Worldwide as they share practice tips and tools that you can start using immediately to help get you through this day so you can live your caregiver life more fully and abundantly. Now, here's your caregiver host, Dave Nassani.
From Los Angeles, a big LA welcome to all my listeners out there in radio land. I am Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, coming to you live globally through the famous HealthStar Worldwide Radio Network. Yes, folks, I am the guy who's going to help you and guide you through this very difficult journey called caregiving. And we are going to do our very best to help you avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout. That is a nasty thing, I'm telling you. Now, my usual co-host with me, who's usually sitting by me in another state, like New York, is Adrienne Gruberg. She could not make it today. Number one, because, you know, they're just under 1,200 feet of snow. And also, she was invited today to a Broadway musical and dinner, and it was just too inconvenient. And because I am the caregiver's caregiver, I just don't like to make caregivers' lives harder than they already are. So I gave her the day off. And apparently the theaters are open and the roads are open and the police have let people come out of their house. So we're excited for her. So we still have an exciting show planned for you today. So stay tuned. Registered nurse and caregiver Susan Shepherd. We're talking all about burnout, and she is an expert. And there is no, I don't know, I can think of two people who are really experts in caregiving. One are caregivers, of course. I'm sorry, I meant two people who are experts in burnout. And caregivers are one, of course. And registered nurses, especially if you're in the ER, would be the other group. So you do not want to miss this interview. I'm your host, Dave Nassani, and this show is to caregivers of every kind. And the one thing we know about caregivers, because we know a few things about them, that they're caring, okay, and they're selfless, yeah, and they're sacrificial. Oh, yeah, and they're very prone to burnout because they tend to put everyone else's needs above their own. Folks, come on, learn a lesson from the airlines. Remember every time you board a plane, you tune them out? When they start to tell you that if there's an emergency, to put your own oxygen mask on first. And why do they do that? I mean, how selfish, right? Because they know from experience that you will most likely black out if you don't put your needs above the needs of your loved ones. And then guess what? You won't be of any help to anybody with anything. And, caregivers are exactly the same way. Yes, they are. Now, we also talk about grief and loss here and the devastating effects it can have on us. It automatically throws us into this other thing, just what we need, another thing called the grief process. Ouch. Unfortunately, folks, there's only one way out of the grief process, and that's to go through the grief process. You can't go around it, can't go over it, can't go under it. Sorry, got to go through it. And hopefully we can help you through your grief and your loss if you happen to feel like, you know, you're stuck. Hey, if this is your first time tuning in, you can learn more about me and my show, my radio podcast, my books, my videos, my blog. I know it sounds like it's all about me, but it's not. It's actually all about you. So go to my website, caregiverscaregiver.com, and take our short quiz that will assess if you are a candidate for burnout. And just for doing that, because I'm such a nice guy, I'm going to email you my first book I wrote, One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships, absolutely free. That's my story about my caregiving experience and my amazing wife that makes us normal people look like whiners and complainers. And whenever I get a little discouraged, I just look at her and say, wow, try walking, 100 feet in her moccasins and you learn to appreciate how good you've got it. Now, I want to take this moment and thank my last week's guest, caregiver Michelle Castellano, and that's Italian if you didn't know, and also my co-host Adrienne Gruberg. great show. It's on my website. All these shows become property of the internet and me forever, so you can hear them anytime you want, including this one, like I said. All right, enough of that. Susan, welcome, and thank you so much for patiently sitting through all this introduction stuff for our first-time listeners.
No problem, Dave. I'm just happy to be here.
Wow, she has such a sexy voice. You know, Susan was on this calendar, and I'm sorry for sharing that, Susan, but, you know, tell us a little about the calendar first, because I think that's interesting.
Okay, well, the calendar was a brainstorm idea of mine. About a little more than a year ago, it was November. I was watching Good Morning America. Helen Mirren was on there, and I was sort of brainstorming about something to do with my other business, which is I actually heal broken hearts and work with people to give them a relationship, a love relationship. I have evolved from being a registered nurse in the emergency department and then a studio nurse. And now I am strictly I'm an author, I'm a coach, I do all this stuff, you know, that has to do with that. But mostly what I do is I coach people with wounded or broken hearts to find love again. And it's just another way of healing people. And I discovered some time ago that I am a healer and an influencer. And so I like to influence people to do things that work for them and heal them from their, now I do broken hearts, and it works really well. So I had this idea that we had a lot of entrepreneurs in our mastermind who were over the age of 50, and a lot of them were women. And I went, why don't we make a calendar? Because I saw Helen Mirren, I remembered her, that movie, Calendar Girls. And so I talked to our photographer, Stephanie Westover, who is a genius. And I said, what do you think? Should we do this? And we started taking the pictures. And so we ended up with a calendar. It's not X-rated at all. It's it's class. It's women. The women of class is what it's called.
So you show a little skin, right? In all the right spots.
Let's just put it this way. Everyone started out nude and got covered up. So you don't really see anything that is X-rated or even R-rated. It's just classy sensuality.
Wow. And this is still January, so it's not too late to get one from you. We'll give that information out if you still have some at the end
of
the show.
We do.
Right.
The womenofclass.com. That's where they go.
Yeah. Okay. A little shameless plug there. Good.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have a healer on the show, Susan, because if any group of people need healing, it is caregivers. And if anyone needs help with burnout, it is caregivers. And who better to tell us about burnout, how it happens, how to avoid it, what you do if you find out you already have it, is a registered nurse in the ER. So first, tell us, take us down this treacherous road of, you know, what made you even want to be a nurse? And after you became a nurse, did you like say, oh my God, what did I get myself into? And then, you know, just let it progress from there.
I didn't want to be a nurse. I never wanted to be a nurse.
Most little girls want to be a nurse.
No, I didn't want to be a nurse. I wanted to be an engineer.
Wow.
And in the 50s, when I was in high school, I wanted to take a mechanical drawing class, and the school board refused to allow me to take a mechanical drawing class because I was a girl. They recommended I take home economics classes. Well, that kind of made me mad to start with, because I really wanted to be an engineer. So then, a little bit later, I was an honor student and all that nonsense that you do when you get good grades and everybody encourages you to take all these college prep classes. Mm-hmm. So when I was a junior, we started filling out applications for colleges, and I took them home to my parents, and they said, well, there's no money for you to go to school. I'm like, what do you mean? And they said, there's six kids in this family, 3 girls, 3 boys. You're the oldest one. And there's $20,000 insurance policies for the boys to go to school because they're going to have to support a family. But you girls, all you're going to do is get married and stay home. So we only got $2,000 policies for you.
Oh my gosh, what year was this? Like 1970?
50, it was 59.
Wow. We forget how things were in the good old days, right?
Yep. So I got mad and I said, all right, fine. That $2,000 that you have earmarked for my wedding, which I'm not about to get married at this point. I'm only 17 years old to begin with. And I went searching for a school that I could go to where it would pay my tuition for, you know, with $2,000. And what I found was that nursing schools, hospital-based nursing schools that were affiliated with universities, particularly Evanston Hospital, which is where I went to school. It doesn't even have a nursing school anymore, but Evanston Hospital, which was an affiliate of Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, I could go to nursing school for 3 years, year-round, room and board included, for $2,000.
Wow.
That was my ticket.
To get out of the house, too, right?
Yeah, my ticket to get out of that small town, population 3,000 in Illinois.
Okay, did they put you right in an emergency room after you graduated?
No, not exactly. I was lucky to graduate because I was sort of a rebel. It may show. but when I was in nursing school and I didn't really like nursing school. I didn't like having to be subservient to the doctors and stand up and give up my chair to them when they came in to sit down. And so when I got out of school, I had a list of things I didn't want to have to do when I got a job. And I said, I don't want to do charting about people's bodily functions. I don't want to pass trays of medicines to people that I don't know. I want to be able to talk to patients. And I don't even like giving bed baths to those dirty old men who were recovering from a heart attack, because in those days they didn't even have a critical care unit. They had ICU, but they didn't have coronary care unit. So people who had heart attacks had to lay flat in bed for 6 weeks, and mostly the student nurses got to give these men bed baths. And the men loved it. We hated it.
So you really wanted to be a doctor.
I would have chosen a doctor over being a nurse, absolutely. So anyway, I made this list, and then I said, okay, where can I work where I don't have to do any of these things? And I came up with two places. One was the operating room, mm-hmm. and the other one was the emergency room. And I said, well, the patients in the operating room, they're always unconscious, so I can't even talk to them. So that was out.
Good point.
And the emergency room, when I was a student in the emergency room, I got my picture on the front page of the Chicago Sun-Times because there was a robbery in the hospital. And I was wheeling security guards who got shot out in the, you know, the press took a picture of me. So I got my picture on the front page of the Chicago Sun-Times. And I thought, well, maybe I could even get famous if I worked in the ER. So I went to work in the ER. And amazing thing happened. I loved it. And there were reasons why I loved it. I loved it because, first of all, it was different every single day. I never did the same thing 2 days in a row, ever in 40 years. I ended up staying in the emergency room for 40 years. And 40 years in the emergency room is almost a miracle.
Sure. When did it stop being fun and you started getting stressed out and approaching burnout?
It never did.
Well, that's good. Were you ever burned out as a registered nurse?
I have to say I don't think so. I got burned out on jobs, but not on the nursing or the patients. And I was an administrator for 20 of those years, and I never got burned out on my staff. I got burned out on administration, on the frustration of trying to do the right thing and handle the priorities the way I felt they should be handled.
Well, you've worked with a lot of nurses. Is that unusual? I mean, are most nurses, every time I go to the hospital, which isn't much, but, you know, I've been there my fair share amount of times, it just seems like they're overworked and, God, probably underpaid for what they do. And they do these long shifts and overtime, and someone doesn't show up and they got to call, you know, call in, maybe go without sleep for a couple of days. So
yeah,
that just sounds like
right.
Yeah. So how does the average nurse?
How did I do that without first, getting burned out?
Yeah. First, how does the average nurse do it, and then what made you different so that, you know, you handled it differently or responded differently, I should say.
I think I'm going to answer it in reverse, the way I did it first, because mm-hmm. I think what I did was the only reason I didn't burn out. I only stayed in a job if I was having fun. When it wasn't fun anymore, I would quit and go somewhere else.
It's a good attitude.
So it was sort of a rule of thumb for me. As long as I was enjoying myself, and enjoying myself, maybe I'm a little bit warped because I liked the chaos. I loved the chaos. I loved the unpredictability. I loved the fact that I had no idea what was coming through that door and that it would be crazy. And the busier it was, the more I liked it.
Ooh, cool.
So I think that's what a true ER nurse has to be. Otherwise, they will burn out. Because I think that the people who got frustrated with the craziness were the ones who burnt out. Because it wasn't their choice of what to do. And so I think the only reason that I loved the ER so much was because of the chaos, because of the unpredictability, and because nurses in the emergency room have a lot more autonomy than they do in other parts of the hospital. Mm-hmm. Because the nurses in the emergency room, they see the patients first and tell the doctors what to do.
Yeah. So this is off the topic, but since you're an expert, what have you seen as far as what advice can you give to caregivers, first of all, when they bring their loved ones in there? Because sometimes they feel so inadequate, intimidated. The doctor's making all the decisions and, you know, they don't even consult the caregiver who knows this person better than anyone else often. Tell us what you've observed with when a caregiver and a loved one are there in the same room and how doctors treat them, et cetera. Or, you know, let's go down that road for a second.
Well, my first and probably biggest advice is to make friends with the nurses.
That's a good advice.
And the reason is because the nurses are the go-between. Mm-hmm. Doctors don't spend that much time with their patients. They come in, they say, hello, how are you doing? Here's this. This is what we're doing today. Bye. Mm-hmm. And that's what they do. They spend more time looking at the charts and the lab results and the x-rays and all that stuff than they ever do looking at the patients. So when you're a caregiver and or the patient, your nurse is the person who spends the most time with you. And you want to know there's different – everyone's considered a nurse who's not a doctor, but they're not all – nurses. They're not all registered nurses. There's nurses aides, there's LVNs, there's techs, there's lab techs, and there's respiratory techs, and there's x-ray techs, and then there's registered nurses. So you want to find out who's the registered nurse who's in charge of you for that day. Mm-hmm. Because frequently it will change. And most hospitals and particularly intensive care units, maybe not the med surge units, but the critical care units, they work 12-hour shifts, which means they usually only work 3 days a week.
Yeah.
So you'll have the same nurse sometimes for 3 days in a row, sometimes for every other day, sometimes for one day, and then you have a different nurse. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, critical care nurses, they try to give them the same patients several days in a row so that there's continuity, so that the nurses are familiar. So I think for both patients and caregivers, the best thing you can do is you make friends with the nurses.
Okay. Now, we're up on a break. I want you to, when we get back from the break, tell us like a little list of do's and don'ts. You know, do this, don't do that. Do this, don't do that.
Okay.
Because I personally have made mistakes. You know, I'm a kind of a When I see something going wrong, I tend to be a little passive aggressive and a little sarcastic and bordering on rude. Maybe I go over sometimes of the rude line, because it's like, hey, this is my loved one. You're not caring. You're not doing it. Something's wrong here. And so, you know, I will project the frustration and the anger and the rudeness. And I got to work on that. But I'm sure I'm not the only caregiver who does that. So we'll talk about that when we get back. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Caregivers, have you ever felt like nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and tune in to Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver radio program on HealthStar Worldwide, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grieving process. With roughly 100 million caregivers in the U.S. and Canada alone, it's about one-third of the population. That means everybody probably knows somebody caring for a loved one. They say that there are only three types of people in the world: those who are caregivers, those who will become caregivers, and those who will someday need a caregiver. Mothers of special needs children, family members caring for elderly parents, spouses, siblings, or friends caring for disabilities such as Alzheimer's, dementia, cancer, stroke, heart disease, diabetes, muscular dystrophy, AIDS, autoimmune diseases. The list goes on. Join Dave and his guests every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific on HealthStar Worldwide as they discuss avoiding caregiver burnout and surviving grief. You'll start feeling better in no time as you begin to receive practical tips and tools that you can start using immediately to help you get through the day and to live life more fully and abundantly.
And we're back with Susan Shepherd, and registered nurse, caregiver, healer. Susan, you're still there?
I'm still here.
Oh, good. Before we talk about burnout and how to avoid it and, you know, what to do to not get into it, which is avoiding it, because this is a unique opportunity. We've got an expert RN here, and I've always wanted to ask, you know, the nurse who knows all the hospital stuff, what to do and what not to do, what to say and what not to say, how to not make enemies in the hospital room, how to not make enemies with the head nurse and the person who is responsible for giving your, you know, loved one a little extra medication if they're in pain, or watching them in the middle of the night. You know, just we want special treatment for our loved one. What can we do to ensure that happens? Do's and don'ts.
Well, I would say the first thing is ask more questions rather than challenging. If you ask questions about anything, most nurses are very willing to tell you what they're doing. Now, they're willing to tell you what they're doing, but what they're not willing is to have the caregivers say you're doing it wrong. You know, the caregiver who's there accompanying the patient.
And, sure, they get defensive and stuff. And,
well, they get defensive because, you know, they know they're...
And they start judging you.
They're the expert. And
right. Even and if they're not, they are.
Right. Well, they're the expert, but the caregiver also feels like they're the expert. And right. What you don't want to do is get into a, for lack of a better word, can I say pissing match on them?
I was going to say that. Can we say that on the air, Blake?
Well, A, you just did. And then, and B, I can't think of a better way to to say it.
Yes, I guess we can. Anyway, you don't want to get into a competition with them. So what you want to do is you really want to do what I teach people to do when they're asking for anything, which is to acknowledge them first in some way. And when I teach people to do acknowledge and then ask and then appreciate, it tends to make communication much easier. So when you have a nurse that comes in to take care of your loved one, you want to say something to the effect of either compliment the hospital or compliment the nurse or compliment them in some way, not like, oh, you're really beautiful today, not like that, but like, you know, I really appreciate the concern that I see that you have for your patients.
That's good.
And you have to be sincere. I mean, if they're obviously, if they're the nasty one that comes in and slams doors and is nasty, you don't want to try doing that with them.
Yeah, or they'll pick up some sarcasm.
But sometimes those nurses, you know, those ones that come in and they're really kind of aggressive snippy. And nasty and snippy,
yeah.
They will end up flipping on you and becoming your best friend.
Oh, good.
If you can get to them, you know, you ask them something that shows that you know what you're doing and shows that you have some knowledge about this patient and that you're really trying to support them in taking care of your loved one.
So are gifts tacky or allowed or in good taste? You know, let's say maybe on the second or third day, you know.
Gifts are always appreciated. Not so much candy because nurses get way too much candy. Even though they love it, it's like...
So what kind of a gift would be a good, thoughtful gift? If you were going to do that.
I have to think about that one. I mean, I've gotten some amazing...
Yeah, you took away candy. It's like, oh my gosh. Flowers, maybe.
Flowers are nice. Flowers for the nurses or a plant for the nurses is always a really lovely thing. But
they can brag to their coworkers. Look at what my patient's mother gave me or whatever. And it just kind of makes them feel good, makes them feel important, makes them feel special.
But even bringing something of the patient's to show it to them.
Like a painting?
Like a painting or pictures of the patient's family. Mm-hmm. That, including them in being part of your family, is really significant. It makes the nurse feel welcome.
And they feel maybe, and we're not manipulating her, but it would make them feel a little obligated to give them maybe a little extra treatment, I know.
Well, maybe a little bit extra, but it makes them be more attached. It's more of a connection. Yeah. You see that you have a patient in there and they have children and grandchildren. You have pictures of the children and the grandchildren and you show them to the nurse. The nurse is going to relate to that because most of the nurses have kids.
Yeah.
You know.
So what else can we do?
So you want to talk about avoiding burnout for the caregivers. Right. I do have some suggestions.
Have we exhausted the topic of what to say and not to say before we move on to that?
Well, what to say and not to say is you don't want to fight with them. You know, you don't want to.
Sometimes that's hard.
Sometimes that's hard. And as a nurse administrator, I used to get the family members who were very unhappy with my staff. And what I always did with them was to just listen. I used to let them talk until they vented all of their anger and ask them, how can we fix this for you? How can we make this situation better? Uh-huh. So up from the caregiver's perspective, you're there and you're frustrated, you know, express your frustration. But try not to yell at them because it's not the nurse's fault that all those things are happening.
Sure.
It's not that person. It's not like you want to direct it at that person. You want to say, maybe I'm frustrated and these are the things I'm frustrated about. What can we do to, you know, make amends to this situation or you know, repair this situation? Yeah. What do you suggest I can do? And ask the nurse, is there something you can do that's going to make this situation work better?
So what do we do if, and I'll give some personal examples. You know, my wife had a stroke 20 years ago.
Right.
And I didn't know anything about anything. You know, if I knew today what I do then my wife would probably be normal and talking and not paralyzed today. And in my opinion, it was all the doctor's fault because, you know, he didn't include me in anything. You know, they were taking a CAT scan. He didn't say, okay, here's what we're going to do and here's why we're going to do it and this and that. And sometimes the doctor, you know, is just acting like he's God and he's not including us. And when we have that frustration and we try to talk to the doctor and he just, you know, because a lot of doctors now are from different countries and they have different cultures, different customs, and it's really hard to relate to some of them. And so is it okay to take our frustrations to the nurse and say, you know, I don't want to cause any problems, but, you know, I think he's giving her the wrong meds. And, you know, I just, I think he doesn't understand what I'm trying to say. And
absolutely.
So it can be a like a middle person.
Because the nurse is the patient advocate. Really. The nurse is the...
She's on your side.
Well, the nurse is the go-between. It's she's the person that knows this doctor well enough to be able to talk to him. And some doctors are really not approachable at all.
I know, even to nurses. Like, I've had nurses tell me, yeah, he's really difficult to talk to. You know, I'll see what I can do, but no promises, stuff like that.
Right.
You know?
And sometimes they are that way. I tended to be just as abrasive to those abrasive ones, and then they tended to like me. So,
so it's like the bully getting bullied.
It's like, well, I just didn't let them bully me. I didn't.
They have respect for you.
And you know, I mean, I was usually in an authority position at that time when I was a department manager or something, and I would say to them, you know, don't talk to me like this. You want to have a conversation, we'll have a conversation, but you don't get to talk to me like I'm an underling.
I think I've met that doctor. So what if we just can't resolve this and, you know, I don't want that doctor looking at my mother. Find me another doctor. I mean, do we have that right?
Absolutely.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
What if that's the only doctor for that condition on staff at that time or day? What will they do about that?
Well, you can always ask to speak to your, generally speaking, every patient who's in a hospital has more than one doctor.
Yeah, but they're different specialties, right?
Different specialties, but generally speaking, there should be one who's in charge. And really, you should have been able to choose that one.
Okay.
That's the one that you normally see, right?
Like our primary physician or whoever they recommended. Okay, good point.
You go to that one, the one that you have the relationship with, and you say, I'm not happy with this, and let the doctor intercede for you.
Yeah. Now, in my wife's case, there were two doctors, two different hospitals. They took her to, you're from Glendale, so you know there was a place called Burbank Community Hospital and then later Thompson Memorial. They're both out of business now, so we probably won't get sued.
I actually was a manager there.
Okay. Well, this one doctor, what he did is, and they had a terrible CAT scan machine there. The picture they showed me was this blurry image. It was like this blurry X-ray, and there was like a blurry white dot on the brain. He says, yeah, we think this is leakage or seepage in her brain, so she wouldn't qualify for the clot-busting drug because we don't want her to bleed to death and die. But then, you know, it wasn't seepage and it wasn't leakage. And because they didn't give her the clot-busting drug, you know, she's disabled all her life. So because it was a holiday and that's where the paramedics delivered her, then they delivered her to St. Joseph. And we had a different neurologist. And he was very blunt about the previous doctor's mistakes. You know, oh, you know, he shouldn't have done this, you know, and he's... And it's really hard to find doctors talk about other doctors. So that's why, you know, it must have been so outrageous that he was just so outraged that he was just, you know, venting and telling the truth. Later tried to sue that doctor in that hospital, but it wouldn't go through because, you know, in litigation, doctors will never testify against each other. So, you know, we're trying to avoid things like this. So, you know, if the paramedics say, well, where do you want us to send her? I say, always go to the larger, more equipped hospital, even if it's 5 or 10 minutes further away. Would you agree with that?
I agree to that. However, sometimes the paramedics are not allowed to do that.
Mm.
They're...
But you could insist and increase your chances
and
go ballistic and say, hey, we better do this. This lady's going to hit me or something, you know?
Yes, you can insist.
Okay.
the paramedics, you know, they're not independent. They are ruled by who's ruling them. Mm-hmm. And they have a base station to talk to. I was a paramedic base station nurse for many, many years. And the nurses would tell the paramedics where to take the patient. And
Well, why would they ask me, well, where do you want us to take her? It's like, oh, we have an option. We have a choice, instead of just saying, oh, we're going to take her here.
It depends on your location. Mm-hmm. Okay. If you were in the middle between two hospitals, they'll ask you.
We were at the top of the hill in Burbank. So the closest one, probably 5 minutes away, was Thompson Memorial. Another 10 minutes, perhaps, to St. Joseph. So that's what the situation was in my case.
Right. Yeah. So did they ask you?
They did ask. And I didn't know what to say. I says, I don't know. Where would you take your wife if she was having a stroke? And they both looked at each other and says, Thompson. So, yeah.
Well,
I surrendered my right to tell because I wasn't ready. You got to be ready. You got to say, okay, if something happens to my loved one, what hospital am I going to take him to?
Right.
What doctor am I going to call? What do I want to insist that the paramedics do or don't do? You know,
well, this
you
is sort of
this stuff in advance.
I mean, really, this is sort of one of the things that I wrote about in an article long time ago when I was actually getting my business degree. I wrote about patient care. And one of the things is people should know, what are the hospitals? What are the facilities that are nearby your house?
And
who is your doctor?
Do they take your insurance? You know?
And do they take your insurance? I mean, are you really set up, though? So if there is an emergency, do you have a plan? It's just like earthquake preparedness.
Yep.
Health crisis preparedness should be the same thing. You should know. Yep. Where do you want to go? And who would be your doctor? So there is an accountability for just the general public to do some type of research to know, well, who is your doctor? Do you have a doctor? And where would you like to go? And where is that doctor on staff?
And advanced directives. Would you recommend that?
Absolutely.
Because you never know when you're going to be in that position and they're on life support and now they're sticking a feeding tube down her throat and now they're hooking a ventilator to her, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, you're just too emotional to make a decision at that moment. You got to think this stuff out in advance, right?
I think every person, I said this in a paper years and years ago, when people achieve driver's license age or adulthood, they should be required, it should be a requirement that you do, maybe not an advanced directive, but at least what is the life support that I want? What type of intervention do I want done to my body should something horrible happen to me? And every person should do their own. It should not be left to the nearest relative. It should not be left to the doctors. Because the doctors keep people alive because they get paid to keep them alive. You know? And families have a hard time making those kind of decisions because they feel guilty about their decisions. And unless you know what the wishes of your loved one who's in a traumatic situation is, you can't make that decision. You can't say, I mean, I've experienced it. And I know so many times people will say, oh, do everything. And you've got a patient who's in horrible pain and who's never going to recover, who's always going to be in a vegetative state. And it's like, it's not the wisest thing to do.
Sure. Now that Terry Schiavo case, you remember that one?
I remember well.
What was the controversy? Did she have an advance directive? And you have two sets of family, one saying no, the other saying yes. And one has to trump, right? It depends. There's a hierarchy.
Yeah. And really, I would seriously doubt that she had one, because if she did, they would have had to follow her wishes. Mm. And so it was the husband fighting with her parents, I believe.
Yeah.
Terry Schiavo. And, you know, I wrote, the paper I wrote was Maintaining Life in Non-Viable Patients, and the costs related, and it was an amazing research paper that I did, and I had to come to terms to my own beliefs about the legal and the ethical choices that we could make. Mm-hmm. And before I could even write this paper about the financial impact, because what I saw, I was working in a hospital in downtown LA where there was a lot of nursing home patients, and nursing home patients who have no family are at the mercy of their doctors. And the yes, doctors would keep these people alive when they should let them go and rest in peace, because they had no quality of life, no quality of life whatsoever. Yeah. And
it's like my mother, she was suffering with dementia for 5 years and just getting progressively worse and worse and worse. And she kept saying, oh, why doesn't God take me? I'm tired of this. My brain is not, you know, working. And finally, she had something that took her to the hospital, a heart palpitation. And when they got her there, you know, they were going to release her. And I says, well, what's going on? And then she had trouble swallowing. First time that's ever happened. And so I took that as an opportunity. I said, listen, don't. She has an advanced directive. She does not want to continue living if she needs devices like a ventilator or a feeding tube. So, you know, don't do that and don't do that. And fortunately, I had a doctor who was very understanding, because he could have gone either way. And he followed our wishes. And she died about 4 days later by withholding nourishment. And that's what she wanted. And we had a great funeral, and it was a happy occasion.
Well, I'll tell you something that I learned when I was doing this research. I did the ethical research. And what I learned about withholding food and fluids is that it's a very humane way to allow somebody to exit, because what happens is it throws the electrolytes out of balance. And when the electrolytes are out of balance, then the heart just stops. And it's very quick. It is not painful. It's not like you say, oh, we're going to starve you. And for months, they starve somebody. It's not like that. It's actually, and I personally experienced this with both my mother and my sister.
Mm. Yeah, well, we're very happy we did it. Otherwise, she'd still be here suffering. Mm-hmm. You know? So we had control over that. Well, listen, we're up on another break, and when we get back, we promise to talk about burnout, because this show has just taken an unexpected direction, thanks to me.
So right.
Don't go away.
One arm, one leg, 100 words. Overcoming unbelievable hardships is a touching story about Charlene, a stroke survivor. Back in 1996, Charlene was a healthy, normal, very active 52-year-old woman whose amazing talents resembled that of both a Martha Stewart and Wonder Woman. But all that changed when she suffered a massive stroke that left her severely speech impaired and paralyzed on her right side. She met her husband Dave 21 years earlier. They had a wonderful, fairy tale, storybook-like courtship that soon culminated in their marriage. Charlene had just come out of a marriage where after 10 years, she received two black eyes and a broken nose by her former husband when he came home high on speed. Charlene believed in no second chances of any kind for abuse, so she left, finding herself all alone in the world with her 5 and 10-year-old daughters, Cynthia Lorraine and Deborah Lynn. She started raising them by herself for the next 2 years. Then fate brought them all together. After falling in love with Charlene, Cindy, and Debbie, their love then produced Rebecca. They all had a wonderful, normal life for the next 20 years. But today, things are very different for everyone. One arm, one leg, 100 words. Overcoming unbelievable hardships is the amazing story of a woman's fight to survive. To survive all that life had thrown her way. Everyone who knows Charlene is thoroughly amazed at how she lives day by day, month by month, year by year, and with a smile on her face and hope in her heart that everything is going to be okay. Her faith in God is her foundation in this hope that everything happens for a reason, and what doesn't kill her will make her stronger. She inspires everyone that meets her. Best-selling author Lynn Barrington says, "If you think you have it bad, read this book. This is a beautiful, genuine story from the heart. It is inspiring and easy to read. When you finish this book, you'll be able to look at your concerns in a new light." 9-time Grammy and Dove Award recipient, the godfather of contemporary gospel music, Andre Crouch, says, "Charlene just won't let the promises of God go, and she has not let her circumstances get in the way of her faith. She's not just a survivor, she's more than a conqueror. As the Bible states, you will be encouraged by her testimony, regardless of what you're going through." Order your copy today from the author's website, onearmoneleg100words.com. And Dave and Charlene will personally autograph your copy. Enjoy.
And we're back with Susan Shepherd, registered nurse, caregiver, extraordinaire in all areas of life, healer. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So we are going to talk about burnout now. What have you experienced? What have you seen in the rooms with caregivers and patients? What can you advise them on how to not get to that place where they are just so fried to a crisp that they can't think straight?
The first thing is that they have to make themselves a priority. So number one,
even though that's selfish, right? Because caregivers don't like that word, selfish.
Selfish is a wonderful thing to be. Because if you do not take care of you, you cannot take care of anybody else. I told families this for the entire 40 years that I worked in the ER. You have to go home. In fact, I just had a conversation with my sister. My brother-in-law had a triple bypass last Friday. And I was texting with my sister and I said, are you taking care of you? Are you drinking enough water? Are you getting enough rest? And she said, well, he's hallucinating. And I said, fine, go home. Because if he's hallucinating, he's not going to remember whether you were there or not. And if you don't take care of you, you won't be able to take care of him when he gets home.
Great point.
So number one is take care of you first.
Okay.
Number two is do the work you love to do in taking care of this patient. And if you get help in addition to yourself, which when you get to the point of being exhausted and tired and scared, really, because you don't know what you're doing all the time, get help. Get someone to help you and let that person do the things you don't want to do. And you do the things that you love to do.
That's great advice.
And then choose to have fun with the patient while you're doing what you're doing. Also, get enough rest. Don't do this marathon 30-hour shifts because you get worthless. I used to tell my staff nurses, you know, yes, you can do a 24-hour shift, but then you're taking 3 days off. Yeah. And I didn't let them do 24-hour shifts, but there were emergency situations where it happened, including myself. I did it myself several times. But you really have to take care of you or you're not going to do a good job taking care of your patients. So.
But what do you say to those?
Rest?
What do you say to those people who said, fun? There's no way I can have fun. This is not a fun job. You're crazy.
I fired them.
But we're talking to caregivers now, not your nurses.
Well, it has to be fun. If it's not fun for you to spend time with your loved one, no matter how awful it is, then you should be getting someone else to take care of them.
So give us some examples, some creative thoughts and ideas of how a caregiver can have fun with a loved one who is in a very difficult situation. You know, they just crapped all over the floor and I got to clean up the crap. They don't appreciate me. They demand, they bark out orders. They don't understand. They wake me up in the middle of the night because they need something that they can get themselves. I mean,
how do you do it?
To these people now. Yeah.
Make them laugh. Make them laugh. Do something silly and do what is called in NLP terms a pattern interrupt. You know, spill something all over the floor. So they pooped on the floor. Well, spill something on top of it. You know,
you're making me laugh.
I'm serious. You have to change their state, you know, change their mindset.
And that could even mean tickling them, right?
It could mean tickling them. It could mean telling them a joke. It could mean hugging them, loving them in some way so that they know that they're loved, even though, because they crap on the floor, they're embarrassed. Mm-hmm. They're angry. Because they can't control their body functions. Mm-hmm. They're frustrated. and they're taking it out on you because they know you're not going anywhere. They will take it out on you because they trust that you're not going to abandon them. They won't take it out on the strangers because those people will walk away. But you're the loved one who's there no matter what. And they're not going anywhere. You're not going anywhere. They know you're going to be there. They know you're there because you love them. And they can show their true emotions. So you need to change their state so that that emotion isn't abusive.
Good advice. Now, what if they're just really nasty people? They're wonderful people before their dementia, for example, but they've turned into a really nasty person who violates boundaries that shouldn't be violated. How do we instill healthy boundaries on someone we love very, very much, who we're alive because of this person, but now they're just not the same person. They're just a different person, and they're not, and it's taking its toll on us. You know, we can see our lives getting shorter and shorter and our hair getting grayer and grayer. How do we put up healthy boundaries with people who really have trouble instilling boundaries, right?
You don't.
People who can't say no.
You don't. You can't instill boundaries in people who have dementia or Alzheimer's or any of those things because they don't understand them. They don't understand them. What you do is you get help. You have to get help. You have to get what they call respite, which is relief. You have to have some space. You can always go back there. And it's like when my mom had Alzheimer's and my dad was trying to take care of her at home. And it was impossible. I mean, and I told him at one point, I said to him, Dad, we're going to lose you too if you don't get some help. You need to get someone to help you. You cannot be awake 24 hours. You cannot watch everything she does. My mother didn't know any of us. She would walk out the door and get lost. She got lost in the airport one time.
Wow.
And it was very frightening. And I finally convinced him, you need to get help. You need to have relief. And then what he did was when she finally was in a care facility, he would go and visit her every day. And when he would go there and visit her, what he did with her was he painted her fingernails. He curled her hair and he took her for ice cream. And he said, I try to answer her when she's talking to me, but she doesn't make any sense. I said, turn off your hearing aid. Do not listen to what she's trying to say. And you just talk to her.
That's good advice. Susan, I can't believe how fast this hour has gone. We're just about up on the end of the show. In the next 60 seconds, that's what you've got. Tell us I lost my train of thought. How sad.
You want to know how to prevent burnout happens. If you're a caregiver?
Okay.
I have a list.
We'll do that.
How's that?
Yes. And 60 seconds.
This is for nurses too, for people who are getting hired in hospitals. Do something you love. Do it to the best of your ability. Operate with integrity. Choose to have fun. Keep learning. Take on challenges. Accept a job you're not sure you can do. If it's not satisfying, change what you're doing. Have outside interests. Do something besides just be a caregiver. Take care of you. Get enough rest. And always reward yourself for a job well done.
Thank you. And I did remember what I forgot. What about the people in 30 seconds who say, I don't have money for respite. I don't have money. I'm all alone here. I can't get any help from anybody. And there's no money. Are there programs out there to help people
Yes.
who are desperate?
Oh, absolutely.
And who do they call?
They call. Oh.
Doesn't the nurse have a person, an advocate, to help people?
You know, the state will actually pay for people to take care of your family in your home.
Okay.
And I don't have the information on the tip
so
of my
tongue. Google.
Google
it. I need money. I need respite.
I need help because the government actually pays for people to come. Like I know my friend's mother was ill, and her niece and two nieces got paid $15 an hour to come and help her take care of her mother.
Awesome. Okay. How does someone get a hold of you? If they want more questions
my
answered.
Website, for my love coaching is gettingwhatyouwant.com. And on there is my email, which is Susan at gettingwhatyouwant. And I actually will help people with broken hearts. I'll have a conversation to see if there's a way I can help you. And I'm actually going to be a guest on another person's
radio show.
Website, radio show, uh-huh. who is talking about nurse burnout. So that's coming up soon.
And the love thing, is great for caregivers because a lot of caregivers have put their life on hold. You know, their boyfriends, girlfriends have left them because, you know, they don't have a life anymore.
Right.
And even when their loved one dies, they don't know how to get back into the real world. And you can help them with that as well, right?
Absolutely. Yes, that is exactly what I do.
Your website or your email or?
It's gettingwhatyouwant.com.
Gettingwhatyouwant.com. Thank you so much. And God bless everyone. We'll see you again next Tuesday at 1. God bless you.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you for listening to the Caregivers Caregiver Radio Program with Dave Nassani. Join Dave each Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific or catch the program anytime 24/7 right here on HealthStar Worldwide.